Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix in Parks. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. What's driving political violence in America? New research explores why political violence is rising and what we can do to stop it, by Jeremy Adam Smith, Zaid Giuliani, July 18, 2024. And here are 8 factors that make infection more likely, and the steps we can take to stop it. And last week, we covered the first 6, which were 1, aggression, 2, intense partisan identity, 3, disinformation, conspiracy theories, and perceived victimhood, 4, depression and stress, and 5, anger, contempt, and disgust. So we will continue with this article with 6, firearm ownership. The best evidence to date suggests that all by itself, gun ownership is not associated with political violence or support for political violence. But there are a number of distinctions among gun owners that do seem to matter. A paper published in April of this year surveyed 12,851 Americans about firearms, political attitudes, and violence. They found that firearm owners were only moderately supportive of political violence than non-owners, but that within the group of owners, people who bought guns in the wake of the 2020 election and those who always or nearly always carried firearms in public were more supportive of and willing to engage in political violence than any other subsets of firearms owners. Almost 42% of assault-type rifle owners said political violence could be justified. These attitudes have real-world consequences. From 2020 to 2021, the number of armed pro-Trump demonstrations rose from 6.2% to 8.8% during the same period. Only 1.5% of all other demonstrations involved firearms. As a 2021 report from the Bridging Divides Initiative found, those armed demonstrations were 6.5 times more likely to lead to violence than those without firearms. Which leads us to the common sense truth that more guns mean more gun violence. Shortly after the attempt on Trump's life, the satirical site The Onion ran one of their funny because it's true headlines. Investigation finds Secret Service failed to account for nation's 393 million guns. Decades of research reveal that the more guns in a state, county, city, or neighborhood, the more likely you are to be killed or injured by a person with a gun. There are no peer-reviewed studies that say otherwise. The 20-year-old who took a shot at Trump had borrowed, quote-unquote, his father's semi-automatic rifle. The AR-15, which is owned by 5% of Americans and has been used in 10 of the 17 deadliest mass shootings in the United States. While limiting the supply of guns may not stop political violence in America, it stands to reduce its possibility. It stands to reduce its probability and could also make any violence less deadly. 7. Moralization and moral convergence. In 2015, Baltimore witnessed mass protests after a man named Freddie Gray died in police custody. A small number of these protests turned violent. In 2018, a team of 5 researchers searched the social media platform Twitter, now called X, for tweets about the Baltimore protests. They wanted to investigate moralizing tweets, that is, tweets that viewed the protests as a moral issue rather than as a political disagreement. A moralizing tweet might, for example, refer to people as disgusting or evil or traitorous. In fact, they did find a positive association between the number of moral tweets and the occurrence of violent protests, gauged with arrest data. The days in which there were violent protests, we saw that there was a lot more moral language being used, says study co-author and University of Southern California PhD student Joe Hoover, which was consistent with the idea that morality and violence in these contexts might be linked. The team also ran an experiment using another prominent protest marred by violence, the far-right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Respondents were asked to what extent they thought protesting against the far-right demonstrators was a moral issue. They were then asked how acceptable it was to use violence against these far-right activists. What they found is that people were more likely to embrace violence the more they saw it as a moral issue. In an additional experiment, the participants were given the same prompts, but they were told either that the majority of Americans agreed with their view of the protest, or that few Americans agreed with their view. They found that moralization predicted violence only when participants perceived that they shared their moralized attitudes with others. In other words, when it comes to violence, there's a validation and safety in numbers. The researchers dubbed this phenomenon as moral convergence, when many people come together around a strong idea of what's right and what's wrong. The risk of violent protest, in other words, may not be simply a function of moralization, but also the perception that others agree with one's moral position, which can strongly be influenced by social media dynamics, they write. Of course, our groups often do good as well. Hoover concedes that moralization, moral convergence, and violence don't always have to be linked. Some of the most disciplined, nonviolent movements in American history have been highly moralistic. For instance, the Civil Rights Era Southern Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the American South trained its activists not to respond violently, even if attacked. We are thinking about these factors as risk factors, says Hoover. Certainly, there have been many protests where participants held a strong moral position and surely perceived moral convergence, and there was no violence. Moralization and moral convergence are like kindling, but you still need a spark. You need something to actually light the fires. Hoover suggested that police could play a positive role in preventing protest violence by practicing de-escalation that makes clear that they respect the protesters' ability to be heard. As the research by Matsumoto, Huang, and Frank suggests, leaders also have responsibility not to fuel anger, contempt, and disgust. Number 8, group leadership. When it comes to violence, leadership matters. There are many, many studies, starting with Stanley Milgram's classic electric shock experiments, which show that people are more likely to inflict pain on others when an authority figure tells them to. When leaders engage in violent rhetoric, so do their followers. When they urge calm, people do calm down. Research has documented that words do have an impact on both beliefs and behaviors. For example, a 2017 Polish study found frequent and repetitive exposure to hate speech leads to desensitization to this form of verbal violence and subsequently to lower evaluations of the victims and greater distancing and thus increasing out-group prejudice. As part of this study, researchers surveyed participants on how frequently they encountered hate speech against refugees. They found that those who were more exposed to hateful words were more prejudiced against the group and more accepting of restrictive immigration policy. Taken together, these studies suggest that our political leadership, everyone from pundits on cable news to the President of the United States, would do well to avoid promoting the political tribalism that leads people to strongly identify with one group and demonize the other. They could also reduce the use of angry, contemptuous, and disgusted rhetoric to refer to political outgroups. And Americans everywhere could learn to rely less on the echo chambers of social media where moral convergence and affirmation can fuel violence against people and property. Most importantly, we have to be able to stress civility and humanity toward the other side, even when it's difficult. In 2018, Florida Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo received a threatening tweet, quote, "I will kill Carlos Curbelo," unquote, wrote the 19-year-old constituent named Pierre Alejandro Vargas Castro. "What Pierre did is very serious," Curbelo told the Miami Herald. "We have two young daughters, and like any family, we worry about our safety and security, especially in light of all of the acts of violence we are seeing throughout our country." Despite these fears, Curbelo chose to reach out to Vargas Castro and held a joint press conference with him, where he publicly forgave him. Although the teenager was arrested by the FBI, the congressman stressed that he doesn't want the incident to tar him for the rest of his life. As Curbelo said, "Let us be respectful and sober in our conversations, our debates, and especially in our social media interactions. And as for Pierre, I wish him the best. He made a mistake, and his life shouldn't be ruined because of it. I truly believe in second chances. I am hopeful Pierre will become a model citizen who is now in a unique position to be part of the force for healing that our community and our country so desperately need." In the wake of the assassination attempt on Trump, both Republican and Democratic leaders acted to calm followers. "We've got to turn the temperature down in this country," said Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson on NBC. That same day, President Joe Biden addressed the attack on national TV. "There is no place in America for this kind of violence, for any violence, ever, period. No exception. We can't allow this violence to be normalized." About the authors. Jeremy Adam Smith edits the Greater Good Science Center online magazine, Greater Good. He is also the author or co-editor of 5 books, including The Daddy Shift, Are We Born Racist?, and most recently, The Gratitude Project, How the Science of Thankfulness Can Rewire Our Brains for Resilience, Optimism, and the Greater Good. Before joining the Greater Good Science Center, Jeremy was a John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University. Zaid Gilani is Greater Good's Bridging Differences Writing Fellow. A journalist originally from Atlanta, he has worked as a reporter for The Intercept and as a reporter blogger for Think Progress, United Republic, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and Alternet. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. How toxic language leads to political violence. Research suggests American leaders must take renewed responsibility for their rhetoric. By Michael Jensen, July 16, 2024. In the immediate aftermath of an assassination attempt against Donald Trump during a campaign rally, conspiracies have filled the vacuum left by a lack of information. At this point, there is little understanding of the shooter's motives, and it would be irresponsible to rush to judgment. There is evidence that the shooter, Thomas Matthew Crooks, had given $15 when he was 17 to a group that raises funds for Democratic Party causes. When he turned 18, he registered as a Republican. Reports from classmates said that he had outspoken conservative views. According to the FBI, there was no evidence of violent rhetoric on his social media accounts, and they are still trying to work out the shooter's motive. This absence of evidence hasn't stopped partisan figures making irresponsible claims that the shooter was radicalized by President Joe Biden, the Democrats, and the news media. Senator J.D. Vance, a Republican from Ohio, since named Trump's vice presidential candidate, posted on X, "Today is not just some isolated incident. The central premise of the Biden campaign is that President Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs." That rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination. Also on X, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, framed the death of a rally attendee as someone murdered at the hands of a Democrat political violence. Representative Steve Scalise, a Republican from Louisiana, issued a statement claiming this is another example of far-left lunatics acting on violent rhetoric. Scholars like Jonathan Turley argue, "We are living through an age of rage. It is not our first, but it may be the most dangerous such period in our history." He asserts the Trump assassination attempt was an unsurprising outcome of the political rhetoric today, and says both Democrats and Republicans are culpable. but that is a strong claim given the shooter's motive remains a mystery. But it is worthwhile examining the factors that give rise to political violence and the role of political rhetoric in legitimizing violent extremism. Toxic language is normalized. The foundation of social contract tradition in Western democracies is that we renounce the right to resolve differences through violent means. In a democracy, we accept vigorous debate and the exchange of different ideas. That debate occurs between groups with different interests. Historically, political parties emerge through organization as a means of representing those interests. Different groups can compromise on their interests. They may get part of what they want and win something while losing at other times. But it is much harder to compromise on fundamental elements of one's identity without losing part of oneself. This sets the stage for a different kind of political competition that is unyielding to compromise and where violence can become legitimized. If Turley is right that both Republicans and Democrats are equally responsible for what's creating a situation where compromise is impossible and violence is seen as permissible, then we should expect each campaign to cast issues as uncompromising matters of identity with equally hostile legitimizations of violence. We can analyze these claims looking at what the campaigns themselves say. Looking at Meta Advertising Library's archive of Trump and Biden campaign ads since May 1st, 2024, we can assess the levels of toxicity and appeals to identity in the posts they create and pay to promote. There were 242 sentences in 1,339 Trump ads that mentioned Joe Biden directly. Biden mentioned Trump 2,604 sentences contained in 5,722 ads his campaign ran. Levels of toxicity and hostile identity were calculated using the Perspective API, a machine learning algorithm developed by Google's Jigsaw project to detect levels of toxic, threatening, and harmful content in online comments. Trump's ads include slightly higher levels of identity attacks in sentences mentioning Biden, and these sentences are more than three times as toxic. Biden's most toxic line about Trump is, "Donald Trump is a convicted criminal who is only out for himself," which scores a 0.57 on the toxicity scale. One may quibble about whether Trump is technically only guilty on 34 felony counts until the judge formally enters the conviction at sentencing. However, the political import remains that Trump was found guilty by a jury of his peers of felonies related to filing fraudulent business records to conceal illegal campaign donations when he was first elected. Scoring as nearly as toxic is this sentence from Biden. "Donald Trump has a long history of racism and pandering to white supremacists." This is directly an attack on Trump himself rather than an outgroup, although indirectly there is an attack on white supremacists. But even people who might be categorized as white supremacists normally do not identify as such, and there is no call for violence. Trump's most toxic line about Biden is, "Joe Biden's mind is gone, and his communist deep state goons are driving America off a cliff." This statement literally is incoherent. Communism, spelled with a capital C, refers to an era of historical evolution in the work of Marx and Engels when the state withers away without any system of organized repression over people. Communism, however, unrealistic as it may be, precludes the possibility of deep state goons with hidden machinations. Political language needs to cool down immediately. Ambiguous language with little tether to reality is a common tactic of propagandists, as its layers of contradiction confound clear refutations. This phrasing implies a threat to an in-group, an element of Trump's messaging that has figured since the 2016 campaign. Although there is no direct appeal to violence in these ads, he has made comments that place violence on the table, claiming that there will be a bloodbath if he loses the election. This does not appear to be a case where both sides are equally responsible for raising the prospects of political violence. Trump and his supporters couch the election as a referendum on an uncompromisable cultural battle where violence may be required. You've been listening to Greater Good Magazine, bringing you Sun Sounds, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, in Parks. Thank you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful and peaceful rest of your day. And now stay tuned for more programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.